Hi, and welcome to Filmmakers Compass Podcast, the show where we talk about movies and one more movies. I'm D-Man, joined by CP. And CP, I really love your shirt today. So for anybody that's just listening, can you explain what it is that you're wearing?
Rocking the old school classic Spider-Man shirt.
You're on theme for our episode this week, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But as always, to start off our episodes, I would like to jump into shout outs. So first up this week, we have CP, we have Ivor, and he actually said, guys, I would be happy to come on and talk theories. Delightful. I'm so excited. That pretty much assures that Ivor will be here soon, and we're going to have some good conversations ready for him. I definitely want to pick his brain on a couple of these MCU theories. So he did ask, as far as WonderCon/CinemaCon, he did ask, were the events full or packed? Meaning, were the fans in full force for all of those announcements and trailers that we discussed on last week's episode? From the footage that I have seen, yes, it was packed. And yes, they were very enthusiastic. I know it's not Comic-Con. It did look like that the fans came out in full force. So that was pretty exciting. CP, it's another one of these comments. He goes on to say, everything CP said about Civil War is the same for me. More people agreeing with you, which, wow.
I mean, if you look at the trailer for Civil War, or not the trailer, the poster. When I was in the movie theater, I started to say one of the big, massive posters for it. And it shows the Statue of Liberty surrounded by fighter jets and aircraft carriers, giving you the impression that this is like a very military combat-heavy movie. And you just don't quite get that from the film.
Yeah, he said, went in thinking I am seeing one kind of movie, came out liking what I saw. CP didn't mention this, so I will. Jesse Plemons continues to show why he is one of the best working today, which I actually agree with that. I thought, on that note, CP, I did see Civil War.
Yay! What did you think?
I agree with you in that I really didn't think it was going to be so heavily focused on photography specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, I did know from the trailer that there were journalists in it, but I figured, like you said, it was going to be sort of a military action movie, and that, you know how they have like zombie movies, you have like your group and then slowly mm-hmm. people in that group die. In this case, it's literally a group of journalists, of photographers specifically. I thought it was going to be just a military group with a journalist being one person in that group. And so it was weird because there's this actual overall focus on, they use literally like freeze frames as shots throughout the film, sort of as these photographers are capturing live action in the moment. Mm-hmm. But the movie itself is really about how people deal with both capturing such awful moments and feeling alive sort of at the same time.
Yeah, it right.
Sort of gives that rush to be out there and doing what they do, even though it's as dangerous as it is. So, Ivor, I do agree, though, that Jesse Plemons' scene, which is featured heavily in the trailer, so it's not a spoiler, is literally like one of the most suspenseful scenes in the movie. So it was pretty good. CP, on that note, I got to give a shout out to George and Steph, my wife, for going to Civil War with me. I don't go to the movies usually alone like you do, which I don't mean that as a knock.
I think it's awesome. I was like, well, I mean, I have friends, CP, and you don't.
I mean, I didn't mean it that way. I kind of wish I went.
That's kind of how it sounded. Oh. That's kind of how it sounded.
I'm sorry. All right. So on our next shout out, CP went to see Dune Part 2 in theaters again. And Jacqueline replied, again, really? So I don't know how many times you've seen it or will continue to see it. Was that your last one?
No, I would like to see it one more time if I can. Why not?
Yeah, it's Claudia chimed in too and said movie dramas. I don't know, CP. You might need to see it a couple more times. Make sure you got every little detail. Once you bring it home, you're going to have to really squint at that screen. And then for your preview for the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, Alyssa Stackhouse said about Henry Cavill, he was born to be in action movies, but put this man in a rom-com. I don't disagree with you. I think there's a lot of great leading men who have made also at least one signature rom-com. McConaughey, looking at you. Who's that guy from Top Gun right now? He was just in that one.
Glenn Powell.
Yeah, that guy rocked. It sounds weird to say. I know he's going to be in the new movie Twisters, which I can't tell if that's a sequel or a remake of the original.
But it's definitely a rom-com.
No, I hope not. I mean, I swear to God, if there's not a flying cow in Twisters, then they've failed. Like, if they don't have it right now, they should pay attention to the comment sections of the trailer and just get a shot in there. A flying cow. Yeah, and then finally, I wanted to just bring this up because I thought it was cool. Anthony said he finally saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Cool, Anthony, you're only like 45 years late to the party, man.
Yeah, but I mean, man, what a movie to hold out on. I actually met up with him last week when we were talking movies, and he had brought up that he hadn't seen, oh my gosh, it's slipping my mind, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and what's like, I can't think of the
I
famous sci-fi movie right before Star Wars, Stanley Kubrick. Is it Kubrick?
2001.
Yeah, 2001. Yeah. Why was that slipping my mind?
I don't
God.
know. I don't know.
I need some coffee. Yeah, he hadn't seen either of those, so he started with Close Encounters and actually enjoyed it. It's a very interesting movie. He got hung up too on the fact that you have a guy there who is over obsessing about something and it kind of destroys his life. Also, he was right. Anyway, that does it for my shout outs on this episode, CP. Did you have any?
To Sony slash Disney for Spider Mondays. Thank you for listening to your fans and giving us something that we actually wanted this time around.
I know. It's so much fun. It's such a great idea. And we're going to dive a little bit deeper into that. But first, let's go ahead and jump into our box office breakdown.
Thank you, D-Man. This week in the box office breakdown, as I'm sure you are all wondering, Dune is officially out of the top five.
Done.
It
You
has
don't need to
slipped
see it again.
down to eighth. Eighth in the domestic box office. And unless I get really lucky and go see it like 150,000 times, I don't think it's going to jump back up into the top five. So I'm definitely bummed about that.
In today's climate, we can still give Dune a participation trophy.
We can. Another movie that has dropped out of the top five is Ghostbusters, fallen from three to seven.
Ooh, it's done too. I mean, still better than Dune, though.
I'm not going to dignify that with a response. So when we look at the top five, D-Man, this one actually kind of shocked me. Number five is Spy vs. Family Code White, a Crunchyroll movie. So that's an anime. Didn't even know it came out, but apparently
Well,
it
they
made
know their
about,
audience. They
yeah.
know who to market to. So they got it on lock.
Number four. A great movie that I've told you all you should go see it, and you should go see it again. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare from Guy Ritchie. It was awesome. Go check it out.
Yeah, that's on my list. I probably will check that out.
Number three, falling from the second spot, is Godzilla Kong, which made almost $10 million this past weekend.
Still
And
on fire.
another new movie in the number two spot, Abigail, making just over
Yeah.
10 million. Did you see the trailer for that? Any chance
I
you
did
catch that one
horror
out?
film. Horror
Yep.
film, right?
Are
I
you
don't know
gonna
if
go
I'll
see
see
it?
that. Probably not on my list. No, I'm not a huge horror guy in terms of needing to go see it. I mean, I will check out some movies, like usually on streaming. My wife, Steph, she doesn't like horror films. And unless, I start going alone, CP.
Wow. Just thanks, man. Thanks for knocking me. And number one, a movie that we have now both seen, Civil War, which made just over $11 million. The interesting thing with Civil War is the total gross for it is 44 million, which, if you remember, A24 spent north of 50 million making it, so it has yet to break even.
And it's probably already slightly on the decline. I would assume most people who have seen it have gone. So it's probably going to be a slightly uphill battle because if they're already at 11, it's going to start dropping down into the single digits there. So while it may end up being a somewhat profitable movie at the end of the day, it's probably not making a ton of money then.
When we check out the worldwide box office, the numbers have not really shifted here. Kung Fu Panda still in three, Godzilla Kong in two, and Dune is holding strong at number one worldwide for the year, just a few thousand dollars short of that $700,000 or $700,000. I think it made that like the first hour, $700 million
Yeah.
mark. Turned out to be a pretty good payday for Warner Brothers.
Nice. And to your point before with Civil War about turning a profit, I can't not imagine that movie doing well internationally. If it does, that would blow me away. My guess is it won't. Even having seen it, I mean, it seems somewhat like a uniquely American story.
Yeah, I agree. So many elements of it focus on American society and things like that. and
Yeah.
how different factors in the country respond to civil war, I guess is the best way to say it.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
don't see there being a lot of international appeal. If it was more along the vein of Independence Day and our civil war was us fighting a bunch of aliens and fighter jets, I think it would actually do really well internationally.
Just add aliens to Civil War, and I think we have it.
Yeah, right.
International box office hit.
That's all it takes.
Aliens. Yeah. I mean, CP, I was going to ask you just with Civil War really quick. Why were they at Civil War?
They never actually, I never found anything in the movie. I mean, I know they talked to like the abuses that the president did. That was always kind of one of my issues. I'm like, we're in a civil war. What an opportunity to talk about power and things like that. And it's all kind of like very hint, like hinted at through throwaway lines. Something about that the president outlawed free press and dissolved the FBI and stuff like that.
Oh,
But
you're right. I did hear that line. I did hear something about like him dissolving the FBI. So they ended up saying something like that was a huge mistake or something. Okay. I didn't catch it. They just are at war.
yeah, right.
But that's all right. I mean, George Lucas needed an entire prequel trilogy to tell us why the Galactic Civil War was going on. A24 prequel trilogy, bring it. Well, any other notes on the box office breakdown?
I don't know what everyone's thoughts are of what's coming out soon, but I'm assuming it's going to change pretty significantly in the next week.
All these heavy hitters, you know, it's taken a while, but Dunes needed to get knocked down a peg or two, so they did.
Wow.
Oh, you're very silent. It's like the calm before the storm.
I just don't like talking about how Dune needs to be knocked down. I think that that's a mistake, D-Man.
I guess so. I feel like it's been very fortunate of its timeline in the sense that there haven't been a lot of major releases since Dune came out, so it hasn't had a lot of competition. If it was a summer film, it probably would have done really shitty.
This
Sorry.
guy, this guy.
Poking the bear. While we're talking about some of the movies that did come out and all of that, in terms of our pop culture minute, you know, I don't know if you want to throw down some of the news that came out this week. There are a couple things.
The big thing we need to talk about for our pop culture minute. Pausing for, dramatic effect. We got a new trailer from Wolverine and Deadpool. Did you?
Deadpool and Wolverine.
Yeah, I was gonna
And
say, I
that needs
just
to,
botched that one totally.
this is a Deadpool movie, CP.
But we all really are excited about Wolverine. I mean, this is Hugh Jackman Wolverine. He's finally got the yellow suit. That's the selling
Well,
point of the film. What did you think of the trailer?
first of all, this trailer does feature the yellow suit prominently. So we get our first sort of official video clips of Hugh Jackman in the suit. I think the things that really stood out to me from the trailer, one, they actually hint that this is not the Wolverine we know, that he is an X-Men but failed in his own timeline and they're meeting up somewhere. There is a portal somewhere in the trailer that it appears they're probably going to come to our world. I'm assuming this is Doctor Strange and America from Multiverse of Madness, and they're opening up a dimensional portal, not a traditional Doctor Strange portal, that will allow them to traverse the multiverse. We saw footage of, I believe it's Eliath from the Loki series, which is where people go to, where variants go to, and then essentially get destroyed by Eliath. So we saw that. There were some clips of some previous villains or characters from many in the X-Men franchise, which was pretty cool. For whatever reason, I don't know why, Wolverine did not seem to be able to fully extend his claws, even though we know that's coming. So I don't know, what were your first impressions?
I mean, it's great getting to see more Wolverine. We'll see. I obviously I'm going to see the movie. I actually was less excited seeing more of the emphasis on the greater MCU kind of tie-in.
Yeah, we have seen quite a few mentions. Obviously, there's the TVA, which ties in directly with the show Loki. There's mentions to other universes. In the first trailer, they actually show, just like they do to Loki at the TVA in Loki, the TV series, they show Deadpool clips of the Avengers and other heroes, of course, whom he wants to join up with. There are direct mentions to the, you know, grander MCU here, and they don't seem to be shying away from that at all.
No, it's a really a lean in, and I mean, we'll see. We'll see. I guess what I would have preferred in a new trailer dropping is kind of like the sequence type trailer, Sometimes we get closer to the release of the film, they give us one that's more of a short scene from the movie. I would
Which I
have
believe.
preferred that than more of the, hey, check out all this other stuff that's coming.
We mentioned last week, and I think they did do that at CinemaCon. That has happened. It just they decided, I guess, to release a second trailer and not the clip to the masses. That was a reward for being at CinemaCon. Like we said last week, the reception to it was great. Fans loved it, so I imagine CP, we will love it too.
I'm excited about it.
So I fully expect to enjoy Deadpool more than Dune Part 2.
You probably will.
I think so. I mean, I don't think you will. And that's okay, just because I know that you don't always have the best taste
I
with
know, and
movies.
you're a big Marvel guy too, though. You're a big Marvel guy, and that's kind of your thing. I get it. I understand.
You're just not taking the bait. We'll get there. But all right, CP, to line up with what you're wearing, your Spider-Man digs, and your comment earlier in which you mentioned that AMC, or I think it's even Regal, some of the other movie theaters, they're doing something called Spider Mondays, which for anybody that hasn't seen any promotion for this, you can usually there's posters up at the theater, so you've probably needed to go to the theater to know about this. I don't believe they're running commercials or anything, or within the theater chain's apps, it's being promoted. The Spider-Man films are back in theaters, which is pretty cool. Basically, on April 15th, they brought Spider-Man 1 from the Sam Raimi trilogy, Tobey Maguire, back to the theaters, and each week they are releasing the next in the Spider-Man series. This previous week was Spider-Man 2, then they're doing 3, then they're doing The Amazings, and then they're doing the Tom Holland MCU Spider-Man films. What a spring, but I think for many people, the exciting part about this announcement is that they get a chance to see the old Tobey Maguire movies from the early 2000s in the theaters again, particularly with the Tom Holland ones. Some of those have been released, I mean, I think within the last 4 years, four and a half years. So that's kind of interesting because, most of those movies I did just see in theaters probably within the last, 7 or 8 years. But the Tobey Maguire ones, I'm like, wow, this is incredible. So on a scale from 1 to 10, how excited were you for Spider Mondays? And do you like that name?
I think it works. It's kind of catchy. We've found ourselves saying it like 5 times on this podcast already. So something clicked with it. So good job, marketing department. I was really excited, especially like you. I wanted to see the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films because we haven't seen them since the early 2000s. And I was like, I was a kid. Let's see it again. This will be a lot of fun.
I know
And
it's kind of
did not
interesting because
disappoint.
I think about for us, you see a movie and usually within 6 months, at least at that time, you're getting a DVD copy. It's being released. You can see it on TV. It's interesting because I think back to, times before, like when we were even cinema goers, right? They didn't even have like VHS prior to the 80s. So like if you were going to watch a movie, you basically just had to go see it in theaters. And then once it was out of theaters, like that's it. You don't get to see it again. Even though you could get home movie, here we are all these years later. It's like I haven't seen Spider-Man or Spider-Man 2 in theaters in roughly 20 years. I watch it all the time. I've seen them, but unless we get an event or a special anniversary release, for a movie that we really enjoyed, you don't get opportunities to see these movies on the big screen again. It just doesn't happen.
No, that's true.
It's very rare. So it was something that I think you and I both recognized and we wanted to go see. So, we actually have made it to the theater to see a couple of these, and we probably will for some of the additional ones as well, which is pretty exciting. And do you think Spider-Man, particularly the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films, since they're back in theaters, I mean, you specifically, do you think that Spider-Man 1, Spider-Man 2, the Raimi trilogy, do you think they're better on the big screen? You should see them in a movie theater if you can.
I think that they absolutely are. I'm under the mindset they're really great films. Apart from being Spider-Man films, they're just good movies. And rewatching them recently, I'm more convinced of that than ever.
Spider-Man 2 has one of my favorite action scenes in a comic book movie, which is the Bell Tower train fight between Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus, which is just a fantastic scene. And it's one that I think is even better if you can see it in the theater. I think there's just such a fun quality to the action because there's a lot of superheroes that could fight Doc Ock on that train, but it would look a lot different. The way they do the fight scene is very Spider-Man. Which I love because that means that, he's not interchangeable with other heroes. You're like, yeah, it would take someone else, a totally different strategy to try to beat him. And when you watch this on the big screen, I mean, I think everything that we love about the Raimi trilogy is hitting in full force right during that scene.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
But sometimes there's just movies, CP, that they're better on the big screen. Star Wars. I think you and I went and saw Jurassic Park. Like, it's just better. Recently, Dune 2 or Top Gun Maverick. Like, we went and saw those movies. They're literally better if you get to see them on the big screen. Lord of the Rings, Avengers. It's just, I don't know. There's just this, like, a viewing experience that can't be replicated, no matter how awesome your TV is or how impressive your home theater system is. Like, going to the theater, it's like this whole experience, and some movies just deserve it. I think a few weeks ago we were talking about The Matrix, another great movie to go see in theaters. Well, and one of the things that does, what bringing up The Matrix, that does make me think, 25 years later, The Matrix is getting a re-release. These aren't coming out due to some sort of anniversary. What did Spider-Man, or what did Sam Raimi in the Spider-Man trilogy, what did they do right to really deserve all the love that they get today? It's been 20 plus years since some of these movies came out.
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think we have to really place these movies into context with when they were released. I think superhero movies up to this point had kind of a reputation for being very, very campy, especially when we look at the kind of trajectory of the
I know which
Batman
one you're
movies through
talking
the
about. Yeah.
90s.
Batman and Robin, we're
We
looking
see
at
the
you.
X-Men movies coming out, which is kind of a new taste, but there's a lot of campiness in the first two X-Men movies as well,
I mean, I
you know?
think Batman and Robin put the comic book genre on ice.
So then Sam
Just my opinion.
Raimi comes back and he's like, "Hey, well, maybe we can introduce a realistic element to Spider-Man." And I think he did a really good job of he keeps the fun, campy nature of the comic book character alive, but he intersplices elements of his horror directing to kind of add some levity and seriousness and suspense.
There are quite a few scenes that pop up that do have that sort of signature Sam Raimi horror element style, which I think is really cool that, the studio, particularly Marvel, wasn't like, overprotective with the character to the degree that, they were holding their director back. I thought it was fun. There's a couple scenes that come to mind, but the particular one is when Doc Ock is, they're sort of trying to remove his metal arms, and then he like freaks out and his arms are like attacking all the nurses. That's like a great sequence. They have that one girl, she screams, and then like her nails as she digs into the floor and he pulls her away. You're like, it, I don't know, it worked for me.
The guy grabs the chainsaw. He's like, "How Sam Raimi is
I
that?"
thought, yeah, I mean, it was cool that they sort of like, hey, have fun with it and be yourself, even though, this is our marquee star of Marvel, make it work. And that's pretty cool.
They also, even especially in Spider-Man 2, right? There's this element of kind of like Tyrannosaurus factor in Jurassic Park. As Doc Ock's approaching, we hear the thumping of his arms and the way Raimi plays with the cameras where he's zooming in on characters and focusing on the minute details of the scene. He's really building a lot of suspense. And even in Spider-Man 1, he's doing the same thing with the quote unquote phantom version of the goblin who's haunting Norman Osborn, right?
Yeah. And they
I
do
think.
sort of have that scene too, where like Norman Osborn takes the serum, the super soldier serum, and he turns, into the goblin. He freaks out. But it kind of, that scene itself has some of those horror elements back to formula. And then he throws Dr. Strom and kills him. Yeah, I thought it works. I thought it worked pretty good. I mean, one of the things I really appreciate with Sam Raimi, I find him to be a very visual storyteller. One of the
What are
things.
some things that you noticed?
Yeah, like he doesn't just simply use character dialogue to sort of tell us what is happening. Like in the first Spider-Man, it starts off with a voiceover and then slowly kind of fades that out until the end of the film. And he really just like lets these scenes sort of play out. Peter, they go on a field trip and they're just sort of like going through the motions of what you do on a field trip. Somebody's talking, the students are talking over it, all this stuff. And he doesn't really get to the sort of like, what is all of this about? He just sort of lets it play out. Then,
Unfold.
yeah, the spider comes down and bites Peter and he's sort of figuring things out as he goes about his day. But it doesn't really like kick into high drive. There's only a couple moments, I think, in the first one where he really is just so blatant with like what's going on. I think the board scene is one of those where they're like, Norman, you're out, and sort of setting the stage for him to want to take out the board. But otherwise, I mean, Sam Raimi sort of uses what's happening on screen to just convey what the plot points are, sort of as things unfold. And I kind of like that style. It's a little different than the MCU, where I think they use sort of quippy dialogue. Well, what do we
To
do?
push the story forward for the
Yeah, like,
audience. Yeah.
well, we're gonna run in there and do this and this and this, and it's, you know, it's funny or whatever. And then they're like, yeah, let's do exactly that. And then they pop up and go do exactly that. There's not a lot of that here, which I like.
No, I agree. I think another, I mean, speaking of Sam Raimi visuals, I think one of the things that he does so incredibly is his emphasis on Spider-Man swinging.
Oh,
You
yeah.
know, it's almost like as an audience, we're flying through New York with Spider-Man as he's swinging from building to building. And the weird thing is, I mean, this is Spider-Man, but I feel like as soon as we leave the Raimi trilogy, we lose that element of it. The only time I think it comes back is in the very end of the second Tom Holland movie, where they get back to New York and Jameson returns to spread his identity. Like, other than that, we don't really spend a lot of time in that way. And Raimi does such a good job of making this feel like a superhero movie in that element.
Yeah, I think there is a good scene in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. It's actually like one of the opening scenes where we get to see sort of like the new suit, and he does have a couple swinging shots that work really well. But yeah, after the Raimi trilogy, you know, sort of just swinging through the canyons of New York is a little bit sparse.
Yeah, it's really weird, and he spends so much time doing it in his movies.
I also like in the first Spider-Man and the second Spider-Man how they have the montage sequence. You know, where sort of they're in the first one, it's everybody like, wow, Spider-Man is here. But each time they have somebody in that sequence sort of playing the Spider-Man music, Spider-Man, Spider-Man. And I think in the second one, it's like when they're sort of like they want Spider-Man. He uses those to great effect because it sort of makes New York feel alive. Can we just acknowledge that J.K. Simmons as J. Jonah Jameson is like perfect casting?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's fantastic.
Like, he literally embodies that character to the point that they indeed did bring him back in a different quote unquote Spider-Man franchise. I don't know. He just nails that role. He's
Well,
so funny.
I think what's really fun is you can tell he's having a good time with it, but Raimi kind of really just lets him as an actor just kind of have free run of the set.
Yeah. Every time Peter like asks for a check, you know, he's always shooting down the fact that Spider-Man, you know, is could remotely be heroic. He's like, there's no way he's a menace, you know. Don't come up with these headlines. He's always just shooting stuff down, and then he's always making comments about his wife, and you know, I don't know. I just think he works so well. He's a great comedic levity to the overall, I think, you know, more dramatic tones of the Raimi trilogy. It also, you know, is a big part of Peter Parker's life, you know, being able to make money photographing Spider-Man. I don't know. I think that just works so well.
I totally love it.
One of the things I wanted to bring up, though, that's interesting to me is that when you look at the Spider-Man villains in the Raimi trilogy, particularly the Raimi trilogy, I found that they're interesting because in a lot of ways they don't choose to be villainous, if that makes sense, if you know what I'm getting at.
No, I get exactly what you mean, and it is kind of a weird
So like if we lay it out, right? Like
trend.
Norman Osborn takes the soldier serum and then he's sort of mind controlled by the Green Goblin, or at least he's having dialogue with this phantom being, and it's sort of pushing him to do things that I think if he wasn't talking to the goblin, he probably wouldn't do. In Spider-Man 2, you have Dr. Octopus, who he has that chip which he's using to control the arms. Well, after he gets shocked during the fusion experiment, they say that that fuses with his spine, and now that chip sort of controls his brain. You know, if you look at Venom, the symbiote is really in control, right? It's not necessarily that the person underneath is using the symbiote in order to be villainous. It's sort of controlling them. And there's this theme with Raimi's villains where he has them not sort of just choosing outright to be villainous, that there's some, and this is kind of explored in No Way Home all those years later when they sort of merge all the Spider-Man franchises. Where Tom Holland's Spider-Man feels compelled to, like, maybe we should try and help these people. Like, maybe they're not bad people. They just needed help. That's interesting to me because ordinarily I hate that. A prime example of what I'm talking about is probably the Winter Soldier in Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
Or Taskmaster and Black
Yeah,
Widow.
like essentially. Bucky is just having this stuff dripped on his neck, of which it just controls him. So he basically, as the Winter Soldier, is like a robot, but it's not Bucky at all. Like, Bucky would not choose to do this, he wouldn't do it at all. And I hated that because I feel like it takes choice and autonomy away from the characters. It feels like, they're not in control of their own actions, and it just lessens, the fallout from any bad things that they do as villains. 'Cause it's like, well, it wasn't really him, which kind of gets explored in Civil War, Captain America Civil War. And, when I think Steve Rogers is talking to Iron Man and he's like, he didn't even, it wasn't him. He didn't even know what he was doing. Well, I mean, they kind of have to have that conversation because it's like he can't own the actions of the Winter Soldier. And in this case, I think what Sam Raimi and the writers are doing with the villains here, somehow they're able to sort of make this work. And I think part of the reason for that is because, A, they're sort of having conversations with these phantom voices, or their psyche, depending on how you want to look at it. You think Norman Osborn talks to the Green Goblin mask, right? And he's sort of having this internal dialogue, but he's not just mind controlled. There's still part of Norman in there. Same thing with Dr. Ock or Doc Ock, where he's like, he literally, like, they show him kind of like look over his shoulder, like he's like talking to the arms. But I think why it works is because the writers are able to convey what those psychological voices or, what they're doing is pushing these characters into something that I think they actually do want. So, like, Norman, if push came to shove, right, without the Green Goblin, he probably would take no action. But realistically, like, it would really help me out if the board would get taken out.
No, and this is, I think you bring up a great example, right? When we look at the character of Norman Osborn, when he is just regular Norman Osborn, right? He's kind of a risk taker. He's willing to walk a dangerous line in the name of science and in the name of his company. Case in point, when they have the meeting with the general, he gets mad when his partner kind of is overly truthful with the military about the failures that they've had. And even to
Back
the
to
point that
formula.
he's reckless enough himself to be like, you know what? I'm going to try this regardless of the human trial failures because I'm committed to getting this done and succeeding. And the success of this is the most important thing, right? So within Norman, right, his own id is kind of pushing him further. And the goblin's just there to really make sure that he embraces it.
Yeah, and I feel like that's why they're able to get it to work. I think the same thing too with Doc Ock, where in essence, right, fusion is his life's work. And so to have totally failed in his experiment and then wake up and sort of be like, oh man, like I failed and I was wrong and fusion won't work. He is like, no, I can't have been wrong. Like, I've literally thought all of this out. It has to be right. Like, I need to try again, right? There's this compulsion to push forward. And then you have the voice of the arms, right? Of the chip speaking to him. And he's sort of like, okay, I need to push forward and I need to figure this out, but I don't have any money or resources anymore to make this happen. Well, they're like, you do. You just got to do some bad shit to get it, right? You got to go rob a bank. You need to acquire the tritium or whatever it is. The element that he needs, right, from Oscorp. It sort of pushes him to do these things, but the character himself, it makes sense. There's an arrogance about Doc Ock. I think when Peter first meets him in the film, he questions some of his calculations, and Doc Ock responds in kind by saying, like, Peter, this is my life's work. You don't think I've thought about all of this? But there's almost this arrogance to the degree that he's like, I'm not wrong. Like, I couldn't have miscalculated. I couldn't have been off about something anywhere. Like, I know what I'm doing, and I know what I'm doing is the right thing to do. And so, you know, the power of the sun in the palm of my hand, right? There's a power element to it, but more than that, I think it's this guy's life work, and there's an arrogance around like, I need to be the one to figure this out. And so when these villainous psyches push these characters, it's pushing them in ways that their characters have already expressed they want to go. You know, where I think when you look back at the Winter Soldier, like Bucky just wouldn't do that.
No,
Like he wouldn't do it.
I think that's a great way to think about it, right? These characters have already demonstrated this, but the normal factors of their ego and their, you know, their super ego keep them in check. Keep, you know, the rational person from going, oh, you know, I actually could rob a bank to buy the equipment that I need. But
Yeah, and you
with
justify
the
the means, right? You go further and further down that rabbit hole, like, well, I need to do what I need to do because this is more important. Saving my company is more important. Bringing fusion to the world is more important. Yeah, I think I like how they're able to slyly do that and make it work, where in other examples, it just sort of falls flat.
Well, and I think the other component of that Raimi does really well is he does humanize these people. And despite the fact that we know what their deepest, darkest desires are, right? This pursuit of science and the protection of everything that they built, he still does a good job of humanizing them. Right. And there's at least a scene in each movie, the one where when Norman Osborn finally discovers that Peter Parker is Spider-Man, right? He pushes back against the Goblin. He's like, well, this is like Peter. Like, you know, I've known this kid forever. Like, I love Peter Parker. I don't want to, you know, hurt him. And even to the point that at the very end, when Parker reveals himself to Doc Ock, he breaks through to Otto and he's like, yeah, you know, intelligence is a gift to be shared. And both, I think the importance of that is it shows us that these characters are not just evil to the core, that even though they are under the influence of these other forces that
Yeah, they're like,
are pulling them into temptation, they still retain their true personalities deep down. And once Peter's able to kind of push that away, he can reach through to them.
yeah, they're like corruptible good men, you know, versus I think, you know, you just have good men. They're not corrupted, they're just mind controlled. And that's sort of the difference.
I agree.
You know, that I think it works. I mean, I just wanted to give a tip of the cap to that because I've spoken on this podcast of how I don't like that. And yet here, just that tiny shift in how they're able to do that sort of makes it work narratively. I don't know, just want to notice that. I also wanted to
Well,
make note, CP, can we just acknowledge that, like, if you go check the news cycle right now, like people are working on fusion. Boston Dynamics just released their new video for their newest robot. AI is almost here. I mean, we're talking about Doc Ock, Sentinels, and Ultron. I mean, are we going to need superheroes?
apparently, because like all the science in this movie, 20 in these Spider-Man movies 20 years ago is, you know, coming to fruition now.
Yeah, if you're out there and you have spider powers, we might need you. Because apparently we're experimenting with all of this. We did not heed the warnings from all of our comic book lore.
Now you just got to look up and see if there's a lab that's mixing spider DNA.
Yeah, right.
And there probably is one somewhere.
Yeah, the villains I think are standout here. You know, one of the things Raimi does, and it's weird because the MCU has had quote unquote a villain problem for a long time, where they sort of acknowledge that the first iteration of a villain is a mirror villain. So a person usually imbued with similar powers and abilities, but chooses to do evil with it. And then often until we got to Thanos in the MCU, the villains were not considered to be very strong. They were generally, you know, they just had some sort of mission they were on and the hero had to stop them, you know. And here I think they stand out. The villains are very memorable, and even to the degree that, right, in the MCU version, No Way Home, they bring some of them back. They were that memorable that they actually wanted to bring the actors back. which was pretty cool. And it's normally, I think, Batman that's known for his rogues gallery of villains. But Spider-Man's probably closest in Marvel to having that sort of rogues gallery. You know, otherwise most villains sort of have like their main nemesis and then some, you know, secondary villains, where Spider-Man has so many good ones. I don't know. Seeing all the villains that we've seen in the Spider-Man franchise now, who do you think was the best villain portrayal?
I still think it was probably Norman Osborn as Green Goblin. Obviously, Green Goblin is an iconic Spider-Man villain, but I think that there's some truth to the fact that he is the best in the sense that when we get to No Way Home, he is again the pinnacle of all these other Spider-Man villains. He is the best of them, and I like that.
Yeah, I think the Green Goblin, even in the comics, it all comes down to really that Gwen Stacy moment in the comic books, which still to this day, I mean, you think of comic book movies, comic books in general, you know, there's this sort of underlying trope that even though someone dies, like they're never really dead. And in comics, that Gwen Stacy scene is one of, you know, sort of the concrete versions of death in a comic book that really affects a character and they have to live with it. Now, there's a lot of origin story deaths, and I'm excluding those. I'm talking about people who die sort of after the characters are their heroes. You know, of course, Uncle Ben died, and, you know, there's all variations of that for many different heroes. But Green Goblin stands out to me as probably the definitive Spider-Man villain, even though popularity-wise, like who is people's favorite Spider-Man villain? It's probably Doc Ock.
Or Venom. I
Yeah.
mean, can we just say, I mean, again, in a testament to Raimi, like Doc Ock is this, dude with goggles and a green and yellow suit. And I think him and Alfred Molina were actually able to bring this character into the real world in a slightly believable way. I mean, this is a guy with octopus arms.
It works. I mean, I was gonna say, I think he's probably my favorite Spider-Man villain from the films is Doc Ock. I like the character a lot. I like the actual like using the arms to climb buildings and how they use him to fight Spider-Man on the train and all that. I think it's probably my favorite. You know, as cool as the Green Goblin is, like particularly with his glider and his sort of like pumpkin bombs. You know, when he fights Spider-Man, it's often just like a fist fight, you know, but Doc Ock sort of brings out the most Spider-Man-esque version of Spider-Man
Well,
fighting.
and I think what's great about Spider-Man 2 is you're absolutely right. It has the most iconic Spider-Man fight scenes, right? The bank where Spider-Man's slinging money and Doc Ock is throwing things at each other. Like only Spider-Man can give us that fight sequence. And then the train, as you said, we've seen other superheroes fight on trains, but we
Yeah.
have never seen a fight scene like that.
And it was awesome. So, yeah, that was probably one of my favorites. I mean, with the Raimi trilogy, some of the other things that I think work really well, and having seen the movie on the big screen again, one of the things that stood out was, generally speaking, I think the effects hold up pretty well. Now,
I
when
would
I
agree. I
say
would agree.
that, what I mean is seeing it on the big screen. So, the movie was filmed in the early 2000s, and it was, you know, obviously early years of full-on CGI still. You know, this is right around the time we got The Mummy. You know, we're dating these movies a little bit. I think this is probably also same year maybe that Lord of the Rings was coming out, and that's like a pinnacle of VFX. So I don't even know if Spider-Man was on that level at this time. I think they hold up pretty good. Now, obviously, if you're to put your, you know, 8K TV and you stream it, it probably looks more video game-esque than I think it was intended when it was shot. I don't know that it was, you know, supposed to ever be, you know, shown at 8K. But in terms of just theater going experience, or even if you just saw it on like, you know, it's on USA or something, you're like, huh, it looks pretty good. It looks pretty good. If you watch The Mummy, it doesn't look very good.
Well, it's actually, I mean, it's weird in the sense that and I think that's been a knock for Marvel recently, right? As the MCU's gotten later and later, it seems that they've gotten more lax in the standards of their CGI. But you're right, the Raimi stuff holds up really well for being over 20 years old. I mean, obviously there's a couple shots that you look at, but for the most part, it doesn't detract from the storytelling.
Yeah, I think, you know, the when the Green Goblin comes and takes out the board at like the Macy Gray concert, there's a couple shots there with like,
Oh, that looks mummy-esque.
yeah, where Spider-Man's like bouncing around on balloons or something, where it kind of you
Yeah.
can kind of tell like, hey, this is a CGI Spider-Man. But I think for the most part it does actually work. You know, this, like you said, the swinging scenes hold up both in their intensity and how it feels to sort of be swinging through the canyons of New York. And I think Spider-Man looks pretty good. The villains, I think, all look fairly good. I mean, the Green Goblin got a lot of criticism for the mask and the suit, you know, sort of having like a practical suit version of the Green Goblin when it initially came out. And yet, for whatever reason, it's held up pretty good. I mean, I think with No Way Home, they started draping some of like the purple cloth to give it more of that comic book
Like the
look.
hood, yeah, that he kind of had. Yeah.
Yeah. 'Cause I will say, I mean, like just the, you know, like Exo suit, it does look a little funny at first. I thought it actually works. I don't know. It wasn't anything that really held me back from enjoying the character. And part of that's probably Willem Dafoe's portrayal. He nails it. And
Yeah.
so you're kind of like, I mean, even if the costume is a little cheesy, like it's pretty dope. Like, whatever. So yeah, I think that works. I think the music from the Raimi trilogy is still the definitive Spider-Man music, Danny Elfman. You know, you hear that music, you instantly think of Spider-Man. And you know, even though I think particularly the MCU Tom Holland version of Spider-Man did have some good music in there, it felt very fitting for sort of that high school era of Spider-Man. I think it works. I think this is still the one that is most recognizable, and it's the one that most people associate with Spider-Man.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And then I liked how Sam Raimi also uses some comic book style transitions, you know, in the films. I think one of the things he does is Peter Parker draws his Spider-Man costume, and then like it goes through the spider logo. Like I said, I like his montages. I like what he's doing with some of the stuff. It's just all very fun. I mean, can we acknowledge how awesome Macho Man Randy Savage is as Bonesaw?
Yeah, that
Bonesaw is
bone
ready.
saw is ready. Yeah, that is great.
Oh, and then what does he say? I love when he gets up there. They're like, "What's your name, kid?" And he's like, "What does he say? Like Spider
The human
Boy,
spider.
the human spider." He's like, "Well, what is that? I can't say that."
And I mean,
The
I
amazing.
love the cameo of Bruce Campbell in and actually all three of the Raimi movies. He's great
Well,
in his mini role.
and Multiverse of Madness, he pops
True.
up.
True. Also true.
Yeah, that was awesome. I mean, that was a lot of fun. I think my favorite version of him though, I love him as the pro wrestling announcer, but I think my favorite is when he's the bouncer for the play.
Oh, the usher outside. He's like,
Yeah.
you might wanna.
I'm here to see Miss Watson's play, and he's like, but not late. Like, Miss Watson told me to come, and he's like, she told you to come, but not late. And he's like, well, yeah, and he's like, you're not getting in. And
Please,
it's
sir.
always funny because like that's Spider-Man. Like he could just, if he wanted to, like go web the guy into a closet and go in, but he never does anything like that. On that note, though, we've talked glowingly about Spider-Man's one and two.
I knew we were going to have to get to this point, D-Man.
Yeah, so I mean, if you can't tell, audience, I mean, we're focusing heavily here on the Raimi trilogy. There will be other mentions of the other Spider-Man franchises, but generally speaking, we're taking a look at Sam Raimi's Spider-Man's 1, 2, and 3. And what the hell happened with Spider-Man 3?
Oh
Because these are
man.
the same
Oh
people that
man.
made 1 and 2, and we got 3.
Right? And we watch it and we're like, do you not understand this character of Peter Parker slash Spider-Man that you're playing with, Raimi? Because you seem to get him through the first two films, and then the third one, it just goes off the rails. And I can only think it's a combination of just a few things. But I think the first thing is there's too many villains in Spider-Man
Agreed.
3 to
Agreed.
make
Yeah.
it be a worthwhile story, right? We have Venom and the symbiote suit, which would have made a great movie. We have this Sandman and reopening the wounds from the death of Uncle Ben, which would have made
Yeah.
a different movie. And honestly, I actually think the movie that we should have had was Harry Spider-Man confrontation as the Goblin who we have been building to through the first two movies in the trilogy.
Yeah, and there's so A, like you said, there's just too many. There's too many subplots being bounced around here. And I think this is exemplified by Harry as the Goblin, where the writers basically are like, we have too much going on, so hit his head on something and give him amnesia. And we can just put this story on ice for now. And I was like, it felt so lazy in writing because it was like they had too many things. They just could not address everything all at one time. And so their solution wasn't, oh, Harry has a business trip or, some other lazy form of getting him out of the scene. They literally were like, just give him amnesia. Like,
Like the
and then that
worst.
way, and I don't even, I'm not sure if this is James Franco's portrayal or the way Sam Raimi wanted it. Like, I don't even really particularly like the way they portray him having amnesia as sort of this like little kid who needs a lollipop and can just go sit in the corner. Oh, my head hurts. Oh,
It's
like,
awful.
I mean, I understand the degree to which, like, if you're like, hey, we're just gonna use this lazy excuse, like, if we can make it awesome, people will just enjoy it. But they didn't. I just didn't enjoy the portrayal of it, and it felt lazy. And I was like, this is such a waste of time. Like, why are we even exploring this storyline?
And at the end, it's kind of just like a the you know The final confrontation between the two is very much just like a lazy, like, yep, stuff happens. Okay, let's move on. Which we have a whole, the first movie is building to Spider-Man, quote unquote, kills Harry's father. And then at the end of the second one, he finds out that
That it was
Peter
Peter.
is Spider-Man and that he has the Goblin's arsenal of technology at his disposal. Like, we are setting up a prime confrontation between these two best friends who, by the way, Peter has in the meantime managed to steal MJ back from Harry Osborn, and we don't ever really get the showdown that I think we should have gotten. And I think that would have been an amazing conclusion to
Well,
the trilogy because both those trains are speeding towards each other.
I think for me, it's the plot hole of so there's this missing link with Harry's story, which is he never knows that his dad was the Green Goblin, right? And so at the end of two, he finds out that Spider-Man is Peter Parker. Well, then at the end of two, he finds out that his dad was the Green Goblin. And he ends up sort of taking up that goblin mantle. But part of me is like, Harry, like you never realize then that like your dad was the villain. Like, and that's sort of like you said, how it gets resolved, where Peter's like, Harry, I was trying to save your dad. He got hit by his own glider. He was trying to kill me or whatever. And Harry's like, yeah, that makes sense. And you're like, yeah, that does make sense. Like, it makes a lot of sense if you just thought about it for 10 seconds. You're the villain. And the thing is with Harry, and you brought this up in pre-production, so I don't know if you want to talk a little bit more about this, but he never took the super soldier serum.
Yeah, I think if I look at Spider-Man 2, the big failure is all of a sudden Harry starts hearing the voice of Green Goblin in his head. He starts hallucinating his father. And in one, it's very clear that this is something created by the use of the serum. It causes psychosis. Without seeing Harry, use the serum or them rewriting one to add in a line about, hey, you're schizophrenic,
Yeah, or something.
like it doesn't really work for the motivation of Harry's character.
Yeah, and
But
today I don't even think you would get away with that because that would be like a mental health thing. So I don't even think strictly like just using a lazy excuse like, oh, you're schizophrenic and you're a villain now. I don't even know if that would fly.
Yeah, but can we talk about the real problem with Spider-Man 3, which I think is the character Sandman.
Yeah, and this is to me, because of the, like you said, the retcon of Uncle Ben's death. So
Oh,
I
such a
think it's
failure.
unnecessary. And the reason for that is because Spider-Man learns a very valuable lesson in the first movie about, with great power comes great responsibility, revenge, and what all of that means. And by retconning it and having Peter sort of regress back to the same person he was when he found Uncle Ben shot in the first movie. It's one of those things where I think, I don't know, it doesn't work.
It's just such a disservice to the evolution of Peter Parker, right? The first movie is about him coming to terms with the Spider-Man powers that he has. He has a responsibility to do greater good, right? While he rejects that in the second one for his own selfish needs, there's another great scene where Aunt May talks to him about there's a hero in all of us, right? And at your core, Peter, you are a hero and you are always going to do the right thing, whether you have the tools or not. And that's what inspires him to set aside his potentially selfish agenda of living the life he wants and making class on time and making rent and dating the girls that he wants in the name of doing something greater. So, as Peter Parker has evolved and Spider-Man has evolved, so why are we at this point now where both of them put those evolutions aside in the name of petty revenge, which, I mean, we all watched Spider-Man 1. There wasn't anybody else there. You know, no one else was robbing the wrestling promoter. No one else was jacking the car. No, so it just feels weak anyway. But the idea to try and reopen something that very clearly Peter Parker has moved beyond, especially since, again, at the end of two, he's honest with Aunt May and like he has no more regrets and guilt that he's holding on to about the death of his uncle. It's water over the bridge or under the dam,
Under
as
the
she
bridge.
says.
So like I totally agree. I think that retcon just does not work. It unfortunately, sort of lessens the other two because you're like, so then did he not really learn the lesson that we thought he did or
That's
that
what it
we
seems
did?
like.
He just reverted back so easily to that same state of mind of revenge. Like, I need to get this guy. And it was, he killed my uncle. You're like, I thought we did this.
We move past it. And then, the final thing is, if you're going to put Venom in a movie, give us the Venom we want. Don't hate, push him to the side for three quarters of the movie and then make him pop up at the end. If you're going to make a Venom movie, make a Spider-Man versus Venom movie, because we've never had that. The only attempt was three, and it was such a half-ass, lackluster version of the character of Venom.
Well, and I don't think people appreciated the character of Eddie Brock in this movie. Nothing against the portrayal of the character. It's just the way it's written. He's sort of a Peter Parker foil, trying to be a photographer and these different things. And you're sort of like, all right, but it doesn't really work because it's weird. Like the symbiote enhances people's certain characteristics in people, and then he just sort of like turns into Venom, and you're like, I don't know, I don't think he was that bad of a guy.
I mean, but then there's even other stuff just convoluting the plot line. Like, why introduce the character of Gwen Stacy?
I don't know. Obviously, Gwen Stacy's role in the Spider-Man comics, essentially is the role of MJ in the first movie, right? And then at the end, they literally do the bridge scene, which is the famous scene where, catching Gwen, Spider-Man accidentally, snaps her neck and feels guilty that it was, his recoil on that actually caused her death and not the goblin, and he has great guilt over it all. Well, it doesn't play out that way because they never introduce Gwen Stacy. That's what we have to get to the Amazing Spider-Man series to get there, which actually works really well. Great chemistry between those two, although I know there was some real life chemistry and stuff, but whatever. And so it just feels shoehorned in here in Spider-Man 3, where it's like, why is Gwen Stacy here? I mean, at all. That could have been anyone, right? It just doesn't serve. She didn't even need to be blonde. Like, who cares?
It was, I don't know, just throwing stuff at the audience to be like, oh, look at this, more Spider-Man stuff, but
Yeah,
there's
like,
no purpose.
I like sort of where they were trying to go with like that next progression of the theme of Spider-Man with great responsibility, or with great power comes great responsibility, sort of there's a hero in all of us. And then Spider-Man sort of embracing those things and almost going a little bit too far with like fame and celebrity. And what does that mean? If you do have power, those things come with that. I like the concept of where they were starting to go with it. They just never go anywhere with it. They don't, where I think the first two movies pay out really hard. The first movie is like, with great power comes great responsibility. Well, at the same time, Peter learns a valuable lesson that, like, if I am ec like executing on my power, the people I care about might get hurt.
Yeah, no, for
Like,
sure.
And so that makes him, determined to remain masked and try his best to conceal his identity. And in part two, there's a hero in all of us. There's this theme of sort of what it means to do good. And by doing that, you can be an inspiration for others. Now, whether you're Spider-Man, right? And I can actually, do what Spider-Man does. It's like, I can't traverse the canyons of New York to be there to stop a villain in minutes. Like that's a perk of being Spider-Man. I can't do that. I don't have sirens on my car that clear traffic so I can skip lights and get there in time. But I can do good in my own life. And hopefully in doing that, not only sort of fulfill my great powers, but also inspire good in others. The movie, the theme just doesn't continue in three. Take it there. And I think that's why those first two movies, there's just great lessons in there for all of us. And
Yeah,
me.
no, I agree. So now I got to ask you, are you, we've had two Spider Mondays, there's six more coming out. How many do you think you're going to try and catch?
Well, I never actually saw the Amazing Spider-Mans, the Andrew Garfield Spider-Mans in theaters. So I'm thinking Steph and I might catch those. I doubt I'm going to Spider-Man 3. I didn't like it when I saw it. It's funny. I look back and I'm like, man, when I went to Spider-Man 1, at that time, there were two movies that were coming out that I did not think were going to be huge in the theaters. Spider-Man and Pirates of the Caribbean. And boy, was D-Man wrong.
You were.
I was horribly wrong, and I love both those films. With Spider-Man 2, I was super excited and it blew me away and totally destroyed my expectations. I was like, Spider-Man is now like my favorite superhero. This is awesome. Till the Dark Knight. And then with Spider-Man 3, when I went and saw that one, you remember I was with you. We actually went, it was like Alex Miramontes, Danielle, I think Steph came. We went, and the theater experience was just bad. There were people talking in the theater. I actually had to kick the back of a chair of some kids in front of us because literally some boys had come up and they were sitting literally like on the steps in the row. And they're all just talking, like not about the movie or not like, hey, what do you guys want from the snack bar? They were just straight up like, hey, so and so's being a bitch at school. Like, I hate this teacher. I'm like, would you guys shut the up? Like, for real. And so the movie ended up being a letdown. My experience was a letdown. And in general, I've tried to watch Spider-Man 3 again and again, and it never goes well. So I don't think I'm going to see that one. And then the Tom Holland ones, maybe I'll see No Way Home, but I just saw most of them, honestly,
Yeah,
in
I can see
theaters.
that.
So they still feel fresh. Like they're all less than a decade old. So I'm like, I don't know if I'll go. But then again, I am an A-list member and I love to go to the movies. So maybe I'll just go to all of them. How about you? Are there any specifically?
Well, I know the audience is going to find this a shocker, but I also boycotted the Andrew Garfield movies
Ah,
myself. Who
I like
knows?
those movies.
CP boycotting films. I did eventually see them on DVD, but I did not see them in the theater. I might go see Homecoming. I always loved Spider-Man Homecoming. And then No Way Home, just because it was sort of the conclusion to the Tobey Maguire trilogy, I think that we always sort of were longing for. So I might check it out.
I think the most redemptive scene in that movie is for the Andrew Garfield franchise.
Yeah,
I
same
think
thing.
that was one. Obviously, it didn't appear at the end of two that that was the end of that story. So that was one that I think too. They really did a good job of giving all of these characters. I mean, even it's funny if you look at like the Spider-Man suit that Peter Parker makes for himself at the end of No Way Home. I don't know if you can tell this because it's so quick moving through the, swinging of New York, but that suit is actually inspired by the other two Spider-Men that he met, like the logos and the design. So there's this total homage and progression of like, hey, all of this sort of came together and culminated in the version of Spider-Man we get now, which was a fantastic ending. And I mean, I think No Way Home was the payout for the fans that have been invested in Spider-Man for, basically 20 years. And it was great to see. That was awesome that they brought it all together.
No, I agree.
So Well, CP, that does it for our discussion on Spider-Man today. So I hope you had fun. I honestly feel like we have a lot more to say. I'm not gonna lie.
I would agree. There's a lot to be said about those movies.
Yeah, I mean, I think, we didn't even really get into the amazing Spider-Man movies today. We again, with mention to the Tom Holland MCU ones. And I mean, God, I feel like you and I could probably talk for hours about the Raimi trilogy. In fact,
Maybe
we
we'll
have.
have to, maybe we'll have to do another Spider-Man episode.
Well, to all of our listeners, thank you guys so much for tuning in. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. As always, if you have any thoughts, comments, or just want to continue the conversations, we always appreciate hearing from you and look forward to your comments. So be sure to follow the podcast at Film Comp Podcast and at filmmakerscompass.com. You can follow me at Big Kid D-Man.
And you can follow me at NDCal5. Thanks for hanging out and talking Spider-Man with us. In the meantime, we will catch you back here next week. And until then, keep watching movies.